we have to be ambitious. We have to be forward thinking. We have to really grasp it and take this opportunity to do something positive for biodiversity. If we wait another 30 years, my fear is, and I think a lot of my contemporaries' fear is, it's too late.
Welcome to the Underground Podcast. I'm Kate, the gardener guru, horticultural consultant, and writer and presenter on all things gardening.
And I'm Phil, co-founder of Right O'Bara, a creative marketing agency for the home and garden sectors. Join us in conversation with those people shaping the UK's garden care industry.
So without further ado,
let's get down and dirty. Hi there, Kate.
Hi, Phil. How are you?
I am very good this week. Thank you very much.
Totally good. I must admit, I am looking forward to spring. had enough now. Although I've enjoyed, we've had some crazy weather here over the last few weeks. So been enjoying some of the big waves, being living by the sea. It's been quite exciting.
Fantastic. Yeah, well, we don't get those here in Oxfordshire.
No, just as well. I think I'd be very worried. Anyway, do you want to just say a little bit about who we're going to be chatting to, Phil?
We're continuing our series where we're looking at how green spaces interact with the built environment. We're actually going to be talking to two people, Kate. We're going to be talking with Neil Beamsley, who's the group head of biodiversity at Bellway Homes. And they're a huge building contractor, building very large developments and new homes around the country. So that's going to be quite interesting. And then we're also, as a foil to our chat with Neil, we're going to be talking with Debbie Holland. Lovely Debbie, who we had on before.
Absolutely. Yeah, she's great.
And she's going to be talking to us about things that we can do, even in a small space, that helps to create natural habitats for wildlife and encouraging that biodiversity into a small space garden.
And I think what I'm really looking forward to is hearing about how our kind of perceptions of new build is going to be challenged. Because I think, you know, for a lot of us, it's very easy to be a NIMBY, but it's also very easy to just condemn every new build and think all they do is concrete over every kind of green field and chop down every hedgerow. But I think Neil Beamsley is going to turn some of that on its head, isn't he? With what he's going to let us into, what he gets up to, what his actual job entails. And it doesn't seem to me that it's just a tick box exercise. It does seem to make a real tangible difference. So I'm really looking forward to this episode.
So, okay, let's have a listen to our chat with Neil. Welcome, Neil.
Hi there.
Hi, Neil.
So, Neil, the group head of biodiversity is something which many of our listeners probably haven't really come across. So could you just share a bit of an overview of your role and at Bellway Homes and what your day-to-day work involves?
Yeah, sure. I suppose it's a reflection of the increasing importance that biodiversity has within development. So I've been in the role with Bellway for just over 2.5 years now, and there's my equivalent to several of the other volume house builders in the UK as well. My role is within group, so that's head office of Bellway. So Bellway is a northeast based house developer, but we also have local offices across the country who actually do the physical delivery of housing. So we kind of sit at a strategic level and then support the local divisions.
Right.
So my role is very much a reflection of biodiversity net gain, which is a new evolution that's come around in the last couple of years, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more in detail shortly. And because it's a very new thing and because it comes from statute, so it's a legal requirement that we have to deliver a biodiversity gain with every development we bring forwards, we need a kind of a plan, basically. And my role is to look at that plan and how we develop it, how we look at that commercially, how we look at that practically, how we make sure that that's delivered through the duration of the period at which you need to apply biodiversity net gain. So I do a lot of support to local colleagues and local divisions. I do a lot of reviewing of the reports we get from consultants to look at how we're actually delivering the biodiversity gain. I do a lot of work with groups like the Future Homes Hub, who are an industry body who are set up to essentially find solutions to new and novel problems or new and novel challenges, shall we say. and also a lot of work with central government because it comes from government at this legal requirement to help them understand how it's working on the ground, where there's room, we think, for things to be changed or evolved or sharing good practice, all these things. So very, very busy. It's a whole new world and every day is a new day. So I don't really have it 2 days at the same. I can be doing very, very different things right out to the next. So it's quite varied as well from that respect.
What's your background? Are you a biodiversity background or are you a developer background or none of
you? Ecology. Yeah, right. So I'm an ecologist. So I did a degree in ecology at Newcastle University many, many years ago. And since then, I've had quite a varied career. I've worked for the likes of the Wildlife Trust. Right. I've worked for local government as an ecologist. I've worked for central government as an ecologist. And most recently, I've been working as a commercial consultant, which is how I had the relationship with Bellway. So I was previously providing a service to them. And therefore, I knew them, they knew me, and they approached me about the role.
Right. Okay. Thank you. So how does your team go about balancing the pressures of development with the biodiversity objectives?
I mean, I would say that I'm the head of a biodiversity team of one. Okay. I asked the biodiversity team about it because it's quite a new thing. But a lot of it is about understanding. It's a new thing. It's very nuanced and there's quite a lot of detail that sits behind biodiversity net gain. So it's about making sure that colleagues locally understand the structure and that there's a very, very formal legal structure that sits behind it that we have to deliver towards in terms of discharging our legal duties. So it's making sure folks are aware of that. They understand the practicalities and the limitations and the potential benefits of that as well. And putting those requirements into the process we already have for developing a site for housing. I mean, throughout my career, I've worked on a range of different projects from renewables, coal mines, that stuff like that, all sorts of different things I've worked on. And by far and away, housing development is the most complex to get across the line because there's so many stakeholders, there's so many things to consider. The commerciality of it is so important. Therefore, it's making sure that biodiversity net gain can integrate into that process and therefore it becomes, I suppose the aim is really just to make it into another thing we have to deal with to get a planning permission to develop a site for housing.
Right. Okay. You've mentioned it a few times now already, biodiversity net gain. Can you just explain what that is for our listeners who might not actually sort of be involved in this side of things? So, you know, just in layman's terms.
Sure. So it comes from legislation that came through in 2021 called the Environment Act. And that's a really, really important piece of legislation that picks up a whole range of things relating to the environment. So you'll be familiar with all the talk in the press at the moment about water quality and discharge into rivers of things. That's picked up by the environment. But in regards to biodiversity net gain, it's a new approach to development that leaves the biodiversity of an area that you're developing as part of a planning permission in a measurably better state. Right. And the key word in there is measurably. So previously, we've always had a situation where an ecologist would go out and do some survey work. They'd understand what's there. They'll write a report, and that report will then give a number of mitigation solutions to how we prevent adverse effects on biodiversity. Now we have to do that as well, but we also have a thing called the biodiversity metric, which is essentially a posh Excel spreadsheet. That's the word, the most basic way of thinking about it. And you go out, you look at a site as it is now that you're proposing to develop. You give every one of those habitats an area and a value. You put that into a calculator, and then you do the same for what you're proposing to do post-development. The calculator compares the two. And the value from A is compared with the value from B. And if that's a gain and it's 10% better, that's good. If it's less than that, you have to find ways to get that up to that magic 10%. And 10% is what we're aiming for as a minimum for biodiversity net gain.
Right.
And the stuff that you're doing there or with the development, you're sort of proposing to do, green space within a development. Does the upkeep of that, is there a length of time that this is involved in as well? Because I can imagine, you know, you might put something in, but then if that just gets used as a rubbish tip, you know, 2 years later, then it's not achieving the same results that you thought it would.
Great question. So from the legislation that sits behind biodiversity net gain, we're required to deliver the gains for a minimum of 30 years.
All right.
So it's a very, very ambitious target, which is one we've never had previously in terms of both the ambition, but also the duration that we're trying to apply these benefits to biodiversity within. So we have to deliver things for 30 years, and nothing to say we can't go more than 30 years. But if you go beyond 30 years, it then becomes very challenging practically to actually secure that. So from a legislative point of view and from a planning point of view, it's 30 years that we're aiming for in the first instance.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's quite a period. So I think that's really interesting. So how has this regulation actually shaped the way Bellway Homes strategize in their developments?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say it's still shaping the way we do things. Like I say, development of site housing is so complex. So it does take a little bit of time to integrate these things into the way we do things. But what it's forcing is biodiversity to be considered at a much earlier stage of a development project. At the point at which colleagues are looking at land, they're looking at initial land deals and contracts and things like that. That's the stage now that we're thinking about biodiversity, because the way that the biodiversity statutory framework is set up, which is essentially the rule book we have to follow to discharge our legal duty, it looks at sort of retaining good habitats first, then making habitats better on site. And then if you can't do that, you take it off site and find a solution, which is a hybrid of both on and off site to make that 10% gain. And we have to be quite aware of the implications and the complications of that at a very early stage of development. So, the land directors, the land guys who actually secure the land for development in the first place, they're now very on message in terms of thinking about biodiversity, as well as highways and drainage and all the other things they have to consider as part of the planning mix. The way the statutory process is set out, it's hierarchical. So we have to demonstrate, to get our planning permission from the local authority now, we have to demonstrate that we've been through a process of let's say, retaining, enhancing, mitigating, then compensating.
Right.
So we have to go through that process quite consciously, and we can't just take things off site because that's easier. We have to try and accommodate that 10% gain within the red line of our boundary for the development first. And then if we can't do that, find other means of getting to the 10%. There's a balance to be struck in that, I guess, because in developing a site, we're creating a community, and that community needs space to walk dogs, kick footballs, chuck frisbees, and all these other things. Mm. And that kind of recreational pressure is not necessarily fully, you can't fully integrate it with biodiversity. So you've got to have a compromise there. You can't create a nature reserve and also a space for people to use to walk dogs and all the rest of it. So we have to balance what we have to do on site with the reality of what we can deliver from a biodiversity point of view, and then make a decision on what's best for biodiversity in the bigger picture sense.
You mentioned you said something about maintaining, enhancing, mitigating, and something else, was it?
Yeah, compensating.
Compensating. Can you just take us through those things? So I think you whizzed through that, and I think those four things are actually really important, aren't they?
Yeah. So the way that BNG is set up is it encourages a developer to retain the existing and make it better. That's the underlying principle of biodiversity net gain. So the example would be we're looking to develop an arable field, so a kind of bog standard arable field, but it may have a small wooded area in one corner. So rather than losing that wooded area to development, what we're trying to do is retain it and ideally make it better. So you're working with what you have first, you're safeguarding it, you're making it better as far as practically possible, then you're developing and seeing what's left and making sure that what's left is also aiming towards that 10% gain. So I think there's a misconception that developers will just go into a site and just clear the whole lot and then that's not the case. And actually the BNG process will heavily penalize us for doing that kind of thing. Okay. So we have to be much more alert to those kind of constraints. And the way the metric is set up is that you get essentially more points for the better quality of habitat you create. So if you've got a habitat that's already very good, if you were to have to compensate for that, it would be very, very challenging to do that because of the existing high value. So it's all about just trying to work with rather than against nature in terms of the value of the habitats and the benefits they bring to biodiversity.
Okay.
Yeah, so kind of, so there's lots of fields around where I live where development is being taken. So we all look at that and think, oh, it's so sad, that field. But actually, a lot of fields are quite monoculture, aren't they? And the biodiversity, you know, can be quite poor. So you are potentially having the chance to make a positive impact, yeah. Definitely.
It's a really good point. And I think there's a real need for folks to reevaluate what wild and biodiverse actually is.
Yeah.
You quite often hear people say, just as an example, you go to the Yorkshire Dales, for example, and you drive through the Dales and you see green fields on either side. Yeah. You think that's really biodiverse and wildlife rich. Well, the reality is it isn't. It's a very few number of species that are very shortly grazed by a lot of sheep.
Yeah.
That doesn't really represent a high biodiversity value. I think if you take your average 100-acre arable field and you did a really detailed biodiversity assessment of that, and then you did the same for your average back garden, I suspect the average back garden would actually contain more biodiversity than that big field, because it's a big monoculture.
Yeah.
It's probably sprayed, and there's going to be limited scope for all but a few species to survive in that environment. So just because something's green doesn't mean it's high biodiversity value.
Yeah, that's
a really interesting point.
That's a point that a lot of people don't think about.
So you said here that you know, it's a statute, it's a legal requirement that you need to adhere to the BNG requirements. But do Bellway Homes actually go beyond your legal requirements? Do you do anything else that that would help with biodiversity to enhance green spaces and within your developments?
That's the aim. Yeah, absolutely. So we, Bellway has a sustainability strategy called Better with Bellway, which we launched about 3 or 4 years ago. Okay. And within Better with Bellway, we have 8 core pillars that the company is looking to deliver it under the umbrella of sustainability. And one of those is biodiversity. That's kind of my area in terms of I'm responsible for that delivery across the business.
Right.
So this year, we've launched what we're referring to as our Bellway BNG Plus promise. So that's about going beyond the statutory minimum, which is 10% gain. So we're aiming to deliver more than 10% on all of our sites.
Right.
But it's also considering the other things as well. So biodiversity net gain only considers habitats. It doesn't consider protected species.
Okay.
And the reason for that is that habitats are seen to be a proxy for wider biodiversity. So in other words, if you don't have habitats, you don't have the species.
Yeah. Right.
Therefore, you have to build the habitats first for the species to come back and to thrive and to prosper.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Which is understandable. And I think that is what it is. But we also need to consider and make provision for those species that are already there. So we're a signatory to what's referred to as the Homes for Nature Pledge, which is an industry-driven undertaking. So from September 2024, for every new application we submit to a planning, we undertake to provide at least one bat or swift feature per dwelling that we build.
Right.
We already have a similar target for hedgehog highways. So hedgehog highways are a little gap in the fence in back gardens that allow hedgehogs to move freely around and feed and help gardeners with their slugs and snails and all the other things that they do from a beneficial point of view. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing we're doing, as well as the Homes for Nature Pledge. But we're also partnered with Plant Life, who are the conservation charities who do things like Nomo May, which you may have heard of.
Yes, very much so.
And Plant Life are helping us in two critical ways, really. Firstly, they're looking at biodiversity net gain for us, and they've designed a BNG design code. And the aim of that is to give to our landscapers so that when they're designing the landscapes around our sites, and ultimately it's the landscapes that deliver this 10% gain. It's not gardens. Gardens are part of it.
Yeah.
But because we can't control the gardens once somebody's moved in, there's a limit to what benefit you can get from a garden. That may be changing, but for now, that's the situation. So they've designed a code for us, which is given to the landscape architects, and they can look at that and find the most beneficial ways to balance biodiversity gain benefits and wider benefits in terms of the recreational use that I mentioned earlier. They're also helping us with the information we give to our customers. I think perhaps the group of people that's been most overlooked in biodiversity net gain is the people who are actually buying our homes. I mean,
absolutely.
Bellway Homes, we're not house builders, we're house sellers. That's the core business of what we do, right. Sell homes.
Okay.
And therefore, those people who move in have got an amazing opportunity to do really great things for biodiversity. I did have a quick look before we were doing this this podcast, and I think it's something in the region of about 24 million gardens or thereabouts in the UK. If every one of those gardens set aside one square meter, you're talking nearly 6,000 or just over 6,000 acres worth of nature reserve that is that combined impact. So there is an amazing opportunity for everyone who moves into a new home and even an existing home to do just that little bit for nature, which cumulatively makes a huge difference overall. So we're very much trying to give customers the tools and the kind of inspiration to do that and to do that in their own garden for off their own back. We're using our show homes as a vehicle for that. So what we're going to do is to move to a native-only species mix for our show home back gardens and also peat-free. So we can hopefully inspire customers to see what we can do, and then they do the same in their gardens once they move in.
Okay. Coming from a horticultural background, so one of the, and I worked as a gardener on the tools for many years, one of the problems is with new builds, what seems to happen is that the soil underneath the newly laid turf is so often a bit of rubbish, really, can be just dumped in, or is the subsoil. Is there a way that you can work with the landscapers to kind of stop that happening, so that homeowners aren't kind of just wanting to put the old fake grass down so they don't have to worry because they're trying to plant stuff, they're trying to have a nice lawn, but they just can't because what's actually the foundation just isn't there for good plant life. Is there anything you can do about that?
So going back to Bedworth Bellway, so every year, one of the things we did sustainability strategy is to bring forward new initiatives and new key performance indicators, is what we refer to them as. And for me this year, one of mine is to look at how we manage soil. So there's two elements of that. There's absolutely the point you made about the quality of soil and the growing medium that people are given in their back gardens. And that's something we need to be very alert to. But also there's a much wider and important role that soil plays in terms of climate change. A key thing in terms of BNG, because it's 30 years, we have no idea what the climate's going to be like in 30 years' time.
Right.
And therefore, we have to make sure we try and future-proof our landscaping schemes to be able to accommodate what we think is going to be a wetter, drier, warmer, whatever it might be, climate moving forward. So we're trying to look at that this year. We're going to try and launch a pilot study when things start to grow again in the spring to look at soil health, and how we store it and how we use it and how we turn it and how we make sure it retains its biodiversity value and also its living component, because there's no point putting dead soil down. You've got to have all the microorganisms, macroorganisms, and soil to help things. Exactly. So you've got to preserve and retain that, but also thinking about that practically. So development sites are very dynamic environments, and we tend to build the development in phases. So it'll be phase one and a compound, phase two and a compound, phase three and a compound, which means we're moving around the site quite often, and that will have an impact on where and how we store the soil.
Yeah.
So it's not just as straightforward as saying, don't store it in 10-foot high mounds. It's, okay, well, if we're not going to do that, where are we going to do it and how are we going to do it and how are we going to move things around? Because we don't want to get into taking things off site and moving it back on site, because that in itself is not good for the soil either.
No.
So we're looking at that with some consultants at the moment. Probably going to try and do a pilot study of that probably next year. But this year is about scoping out and looking at what's practical and how we can go about researching that in a meaningful way. So we've actually got some data we can work with to then take that forwards for a much wider trial into the future.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. And
it's interesting you saying in the previous little question, when you were talking about inspiring the new home buyers. And I'm just wondering whether you see there are any opportunities for collaboration between the house builder and maybe local garden centres or landscaping companies, which would enhance the biodiversity within those residential developments.
100%. And I would say all of the above. I think one of the things that's really struck me working in this area for the last couple of years is how complicated it is, because there are so many elements and so many different groups and sectors of people who were involved in making this new kind of ambitious target work. And if you just take the example I mentioned a few minutes ago about how we're looking to switch our show homes to native-only species. Well, that's great. Yeah. But a lot of the growing nurseries are not set up to provide only native species. So we have to be quite aware of that. And it's there's always a lot of criticism about the housing development sector where we don't move fast enough. Well, actually, the reason we don't move fast enough is because there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the background that people may not see that does take time to bring forward and to change and to educate. So it's little steps towards a bigger ultimate aim is what we're looking
at. Right. Have you ever looked at, as a business, not just trying to inspire through a show home garden, but actually by, I don't know, maybe coming up with suggested planting schemes or different ways in which people could manage their garden space?
Absolutely. So everyone who buys a Bellway home gets access to a kind of specific web resource, for want of a better phrase.
Okay.
And that is a location where you move in and you want to work out how your central heating works. So that's where your instructions will be. Information about the local area. And also there's now a biodiversity and sustainability section.
Okay.
So within that, we're working with Plant Life. I've actually got a meeting about this afternoon, believe it or not.
All right.
To look at the information we give to customers through that portal, to enable them and to educate them and to give them the tools they need to create a little bit of nature in their garden. So it'll be things around what's good to plant, what encourages where bees, for example.
Yeah.
One of the things we'll be promoting and supporting Plant Life with is their No Mow May campaign, where people don't mow their gardens or mow their grass in the gardens for a month. Mm-hmm. The reason for that is that you'd be surprised what comes out of the grass in terms of other species, other than just the green stuff that flaps around in the wind. There's all sorts of flowering species in there as well, which is to the benefit of things like bees. So it's 1 month, you get a month off from the lawnmower, but also biodiversity profits and benefits as well. So it's all stuff around that, as well as things like the swift bricks, the bat roosts, the hedgehog highways, explaining why we're doing that, what the benefits are, how people can help, and how they do that beyond that. So other resources as well, that they can find their own information and do their own thing.
Right. And does water conservation sort of feature in that as well?
It does. I mean, going back to what I was saying about having to have a slightly forward-thinking view of landscaping, we have a situation where we either have too much water or not enough water. Mm-hmm. And therefore, we need to find a balance of being able to retain what we need when we don't need it and have it available when we do. And certainly, when we're developing sites in the southeast at the moment, we've got a lot of issues with water stress. There's simply not enough water in the aquifers.
Yeah.
And that means that when you're looking to develop a site, there's a direct impact on a number of protected rivers and other wet habitats, because we're extracting too much water from that system. So we have to kind of rely on government to a point to look at things strategically and holistically, but also from a development point of view, there are ways in which we can retain water on site, be that basins or suds or swales.
Yeah.
But also the more tall vegetation you have, the more nature can retain that water from the dew overnight. It retains it on site, keeps the soil wet, but also stops that wet going downstream and flooding downstream. There are other things like, you know, for example, beavers, very controversial. A lot of people love them. A lot of people hate them. I understand that the arguments on both sides of that, but there's no denying that a beaver dam will retain water.
Yeah.
And if that water is retained, it's not flowing downstream at the same rate and it's not flooding people and their houses downstream. So there is a need for society, not just the housing development sector, to look at things more holistically. We're going into a period of unprecedented change in the environment and the climate particularly. Therefore, we've got to think outside the box in terms of the solutions we find. And that means everyone pulling together to look at these kind of slightly abstract, but may well be savior solutions.
Right. So a pair of beavers with every housing development.
I would love that. I would think that'd be brilliant, but I'm not sure my boss is in Madrid. But I think, in all seriousness, they are phenomenal nature engineers. They are nature engineers, and the benefits they can bring both locally and in a catchment point of view are really quite spectacular. So it may be something we look at in the future.
Fantastic.
Fascinating. Yeah.
So if resources and regulations weren't a constraint, what sort of additional biodiversity friendly practices would you like to see adopted across the construction industry, not just for Bellway Homes?
I would like to see, personally, a much more strategic landscape scale approach to biodiversity creation. If development is the vehicle that helps to fund that, then fair enough, as long as we're doing our share. But I think if you could pool the resource of 10 developers and then create a 200-hectare biodiversity park, for example, the actual net benefit to biodiversity will be considerable.
Right.
If you compare that with the ability to create biodiversity within those 10 individual housing developments, it's much more limited. And we have to be ambitious. You know, that we've run out of time. And therefore, we have to be ambitious. We have to be forward thinking. We have to really grasp it and take this opportunity to do something positive for biodiversity. If we wait another 30 years, my fear is, and I think a lot of my contemporaries' fear is, it's too late.
Too late.
We should have done it 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Do you get involved in things such as on a driveway, making sure that maybe the driveway is permeable so that water can drain away, and that and maybe even installing, I don't know, some green within that space as well? Is that something that you can directly influence or at least make suggestions on that level?
Definitely. I mean, the challenge is that a lot of the change that happens in the residential housing sector particularly comes from changes in legislation. So we have a thing at the moment called the Future Home Standard, which is, I mean, you will have heard about things like ground source heat pumps and air source heat pumps, and that because it's an alternative to gas boilers. That's a brilliant idea, and it's a great undertaking. And the reduction in carbon, for example, is a really, really important thing. But technically, that's a huge challenge. There's a danger that if we try and do too much with too much ambition too soon, it become very, very challenging to deliver that. So I think it's about focusing on what the really important things that the development sector can influence are, looking at how we deliver that, and then starting small and then ramping up in terms of scale of how we roll that out across our site. So I think the permeability of drives is a really important one, and that has a relationship with all sorts of things, not just in terms of the local area, but, you know, for example, the raw sewage that's discharged into rivers, part of the issue with that is that that water should be being absorbed by the ground. But when it hits the hard surface and runs off, it goes straight into the sewage system. The sewage system gets overwhelmed. They have to protect the sewage treatment works. Therefore, they discharge it to the rivers to protect the sewage treatment works. They don't want that sewage coming back up people's toilets. And that's the reality of what we're talking about. It's a much bigger problem and an integrated problem that everyone has a little bit to play with in terms of how they deal with it and what solutions they bring forward. So yes, absolutely, but it's not an overnight fix in terms of how would that roll forward and how that be rolled out across all of our schemes.
Yeah. So Neil, in your opinion, what's the single most impactful change that we can make to improve the relationship between gardens and the built environment?
I think probably understanding. I think there's a, I think I'm not going to my ramble. I've got a whole ramble about what the Victorians didn't do for us in terms of the way that their approach to morality and things still lives with us today through education and all these other things. But one of the things we've definitely got from the Victorians is the need for everything to be prim, proper and tidy, which is absolutely to the detriment of biodiversity. And I think what I would hope is that what we're doing is to give everyone a little bit of inspiration and a little bit of insight, a bit of knowledge to see that actually you don't have to do a lot and it doesn't have to look incredibly untidy to really benefit biodiversity. And to use the example I used earlier of the 1 square meter in everyone's garden, you know, that's not a big ask.
Absolutely, you know,
And one of the things that we provide for customers when they move in is a seed bomb that you just plant in the garden. It degrades down and the seeds grow. And even if it's as simple as just sticking that in a pot and putting it somewhere prominent so the bees can feed on the nectar, that's a benefit. We would hope that people go a little bit further than that if they can, and certainly engage the young folks in that as well, because the next generation is absolutely critical for making sure they're on board with our message and understand why this is so important. But if everyone comes away with just one piece of knowledge that helps to further the biodiversity aim, then I think that's a really good outcome.
Yeah, brilliant.
It certainly is. Is Bellway, you got better with Bellway. Is Bellway an exception then? I mean, does it make your houses more expensive, or is this what should be, or what is happening with all the developers? Are there more Neils in other developments?
There are definitely other equivalents of me, yes. So
right,
The big four or five house developers all have an equivalent of me now. And they're...
Phew.
It's because it's from statutory requirements undertaking, we have to take it seriously as an industry. So therefore, that's becoming much more common. A lot more of the bigger developers are now taking that message on board. Some of them combine it with sustainability. So you have a sustainability and biodiversity manager or director or anything it might be, but everyone is taking it more seriously. In terms of costs, then no, there's not really any significant additional costs. Creating better quality habitat is probably more expensive up front, but then in the long run, it's less management because you don't mow it as regularly and all these other things. So there's not really a net increase in costs. That's a benefit as far as I'm concerned, is that I think there's a lot of misconception that it costs a lot of money to be biodiverse. It isn't. Work with nature, not against it, because nature's damn clever.
Absolutely, absolutely. So talking of nature, do you enjoy gardening yourself, Neil?
I must admit, I'm not a great gardener. My mum is. My grandmother before that was, and she. My mum is very green fingered. I've had a dabble, but I'm more of a vegetable pot kind of guy rather than anything more than that. I do have a wildflower patch I might add in the garden,
I wondered if you might. So, do you have a plant? I mean, it could be vegetable or flower that might, you've had a bad day at work and you'll see this plant and you'll think, oh, that's lovely. That's cheered me up.
You've got to go a long way to beat a cup of fully in bloom bluebell patch in a woodland. That goes a long way from, and with a stitchwort and alliums and things in there, Ramsons in there as well. That takes a lot of beating. I do love the orchids as well. So bee orchids are my favorite. It's always a thrill when I found one of those when I was a consultant ecologist finding one of those sites.
Of course, amazing.
I suppose alliums would be my other one. I really like a big kind of spherical purple allium.
Yeah, as do the bees.
Yeah. And hummingbird hawk moths. I've got a lot of great fond memories of watching them and the kind of feeding on the allium stems. So probably not.
Thank you.
Probably shouldn't be saying that as a biodiversity point of view, it being non-native, but I think visually, that's an important thing. As they do provide nectar, then that's great.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of non-native species out there are fantastic for our wildlife. So we can't just plant native. We can't, if we want that diversity in a garden.
Absolutely.
Really.
Yeah. I think there's an important piece in there about the evolution and co-evolution of species. And certain species should be here. And
you have to.
That's a really careful balance. But then I'm also minded, we've got a shopping precinct just down the road from us where Newcastle City Council have just put a little, maybe 3x3 meter planting box, which is full of non-native species. But if you go past that in June, it's alive with bees and other buzzy things. So there is definitely a place for it, but we also do need to try and respect balance the fact that there are certain species that should and should not be here.
Well, I think that just about wraps things up, Neil. Thank you so much for joining us today. It's been absolutely fascinating to learn more about your role at Bellway Homes and what's going on across the industry as well. It's been really good.
Yeah, it's been very eye-opening and I've learned a lot, actually. I think I came in with a few misconceptions, definitely, as you all do, not in my backyard kind of thing. So
thank you for the invite.
So thank you.
Thank you.
And here's our chat with the lovely Debbie Holland.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
I love your top, by the way.
Thank you. Plants.
No, absolutely. So I'm going to just get straight into it, Debbie, and ask you, how has your personal experience shaped the way you approach your own space?
Basically, nothing has kind of changed in the town for a very long time, basically for 50 years, apart from just sort of individual developments. And then it was before lockdown, there was a really big change. And I appreciate it came in from the government that we obviously do need affordable housing, preferably, but there is a housing shortage. So I am, you know, not being hypocritical, because I do appreciate that housing is needed, but it came as a shock, I won't deny, because of our town had been so kind of the same thing for the entire period I'd been there. So the first big development, which is really, really sort of underway now, about sort of halfway fully developed, was going to be on a farmer's field where I always picked blackberries with my son where he was younger. There was a massive, beautiful oak tree in the centre of the field and with far-reaching views all out towards the Mendips. And it was just this quiet, nice space that was really beautiful. And I think there's bats along one hedgerow. And it was just devastating to feel that this was all going to be concreted over. I kind of sort of even think about like the worms in the ground. It just really does bother me. So I started taking photos and videos of the oak tree. And at the time, it was a long time ago now, but put them on Instagram. And I went to all the meetings, you know, signed the petitions and everything like this. Anyway, through lockdown, it just went through. Right. And so, I did feel an immense sense of loss. And anyway, time went on and the housing estate sort of shot up and it's still being built now. But we went to go and have a little nose and look around. And I was thinking, oh, you know, the oak tree, that's really, you know, I can't, that'd be devastating if that's gone. But actually, they have made a big feature of it and incorporated. Yeah, it's kind of when you go into the housing estate, the oak tree is there, like sort of welcomes you in, and there's a big green. And there was these little kids that had just come out of their house and they're all razzing around on their scooters and BMXs and stuff. And I actually felt really kind of humbled by that. And I thought, wow, it's the next generation. And, you know, people need houses. And I need to really, I think, rethink, recalibrate how I think about housing. It's here to stay. It's happening. We, you know, these houses everywhere, it's happening all across the country. So I think if we can be a little bit more clued up on how to perhaps help people who've got a new build house, then we can tap into like really actually a lot of space that's available to turn into green spaces or to make gardens out of. But turning on it on its head with my new way of thinking, that's a lot of gardens. So, <Yeah.
laughs> so building on that then, so obviously new housing estates often get criticised for their environmental impact. But what do you see are the positives then when it comes to gardens and green spaces in these developments?
Yes, well, I'd see that there are a lot of positives, potential for more gardens, which is always a good thing for sure. And within those gardens, increased biodiversity, because people can have lots of different types of plants that flower at all times of year. That also brings in different wildlife to the area that might not have even been there before. It's the opportunity to plant more trees, whether it's in somebody's garden or on the street. And that in turn creates more habitat. And then another positive aspect of having green spaces within housing estates, particularly in cities, is that these green spaces are kind of like nature's air conditioning.
Love that.
Yeah, I know. I did nick that from somewhere, yeah.
I like that.
We used to live in Bath and I used to feel absolutely stifled in a beautiful place, but stifled in the summer. It was like, oh my gosh. So we'd all escape to the parks. And then, of course, you know, trees, the grass, everything helps cool you down, provide shade. So all these little aspects sort of help each other. So all those kind of things can be very, very positive.
Yeah, no, that's great.
So you practice what you preach, obviously. So can you tell us about some of the successes of incorporating wildlife into your own garden?
Yes. Well, I've always loved sort of gardening for wildlife and gardening organically. It kind of wasn't like a conscious decision. I literally don't really know any different. You know, it just sort of makes sense that you're working with nature rather than trying to work against it. So different things that have evolved in my garden over the years are, I got very involved with No Mow May, and I've done that for many years. And initially, I just did it each year out on our front garden, and it was so successful. I had people stopping when they're walking their dogs and, oh, what's going on here, you know? And the whole of my front garden turned into just a meadow of oxeye daisies and other various wildflowers, and it was absolutely beautiful. And the pollinators, I mean, it was off the chart how, you know, busy it was.
Right.
And so actually last year, I kind of thought, you know, I'd like to have that in the back garden as well. Pardon me, we quite often sort of mow it around the borders. Yeah, so yeah, mowed the path to the shed and the greenhouse, and left all the other areas really long. And the upshot was we got a resident hedgehog last year, which was a real surprise and absolutely off the chart exciting. I was like a big
amazing. Oh yeah.
and I really do think the big game changer there was the long grass, because you'd see, it was a bit like in Jurassic Park where you just see all the grass moving, you know. And it was like, wow, he just likes foraging around and there's lots of protection. So that was a real win. And then the other things is basically the planting in my garden, and the fact that then throughout winter I don't cut down the seed heads, you know. May look a bit messy to some people, but, you know, around now and February, then I have a big cull, get it all back into shape, you know, ready for all the new growth. But, you know, it introduces lots of pollinators all throughout the year. And then, of course, they've got somewhere to overwinter. The birds have the seed heads. The insects have somewhere to live. You know, there's lots of foraging that can go on, and that's really been good. And we also do have, not in our garden, but we're not quite sure where they live, but basically every single day in the summer, we've got two bats that come. They do exactly the same path the whole time. They fly over our garden, go to our neighbours, and then just give us this wonderful display. Literally, you could set your watch by it over twilight. It's absolutely brilliant.
How are you actually incorporating some of those ideas into the gardens of your customers as well?
Yes. What's been really lovely is I've worked with my customers for many, many years. And so I've been able to start from the beginning. I mean, people, you know, had established gardens already, and then we've worked together on lots of projects, but I've been able to see them through, and then I still go to them every week. And so I can maintain these projects and work through. Like one particular project, which is really exciting, is we put in a native hedge a few years ago. It was a very, very substantial native hedge. And that was an exciting project. There was three of us working on that, but it was, you know, digging all the turf out. It was right from the beginning, digging all the turf out, getting all the ground prepped. It was a very long-term project. And then we put in all the native hedging as bare root. And it was fantastic. We had beech, holly, hazel, maple, dog rose, hawthorn, blackthorn, you know, the whole works. It was quite labor-intensive initially. We put in an irrigation system. There was a lot of weeding, but we mulched. And that obviously does have a massive influence on it. And now it's completely self-supporting. You know, I barely have to weed it. It, you know, gets cut back once a year, but the bird life, wow. It's absolutely phenomenal. The habitat I always have lovely little friendly robin there when I'm, you know, doing the borders. So that has been a massive asset to the garden. It's beautiful. And we're going to put another one in this year, which is exciting.
So this is something that, because often you see people when they move in new spaces, they bung up an evergreen hedge, a conifer hedge, you know, a single crop hedge, as it were, that just blocks out the light and just keeps growing and growing and growing. And again, this is something that the developers themselves could be persuaded to take on board, that they plant native hedges, maybe just down one side rather than a fence.
Yes.
Not Leylandii. Yeah.
Sure. And bare roots cheap. I mean, you know, I couldn't tell you how many whips we put in, but oh wow, it was an extremely long hedge. I mean, it would cost a fortune if you were going to actually do them as larger sizes. But of course, it's quite a sensible way to put them in small and then nurture them.
And a whip is just a single stem with the root on the bottom, isn't it?
Yes, with the roots on. And you get them and they're bare root, they turn up. If you've not got time initially when you've got bare roots, you can heel them in, which is just, you literally, if you've got a spare bit of ground, you stick them in the ground and literally just, you know, wedge it in with your foot just so that it kind of keeps it alive until you can plant them properly. But then once they're in, I was surprised how quick they established, you know, you've got to keep them really well watered. But to see the whole seasonal change, you know, from all the blossoms coming out on everything, then you go into the berries. And each bit was just fantastic. And so it's on a roll now. It's probably 4 years in or something now. And it's this big established hedge. It's brilliant. Yeah. So apart from just a bit of pruning, it's fantastic. Other things with my clients is they've all got ponds, which are absolutely worth their weight in gold with attracting wildlife. They've all got orchards.
You don't need a big house for a pond, do you?
No,
you can have a pond in a pot as well. You know,
so funny enough,
a ladder for wildlife.
Yeah, we have it in our garden. We toyed with, do we put a pond in or not? And then in the end, we have gone for a container pond. Yeah, it works a treat, you know. When the first one we had, on a different one now, sort of evolved, but we had a frog move in without, you know, within a few weeks. And it was like, well, where did you come from? And another little thing, just a teeny little thing that is sort of an observation as well, just about how you sort of the practicalities with your garden is, if you've got a border, a perennial border, which so means that the plants come back every year, it also means that you're not disturbing the soil so much, because once you've put them in, they're there. You can just mulch on top and just keep putting the goodness onto the surface, but you don't have to do any digging around. And one thing, you know, we sort of hear a lot about the no dig movement, which I do really wholeheartedly embrace. It's the worms, funny enough, that make such an important difference to our soil. But worms, their casts and all their sort of little holes underground, they can have those for many, many years. And so when we get a little bit sort of busy with the old garden fork, it can destroy that. So, and mycorrhizal fungi as well, obviously that's absolutely essential to all the plants talking to each other and, you know, the water and nutrients sort of absorption. So just, you know, laying off the digging where we can. You know, sometimes it's unavoidable, but, you know, the little tips where you can sort of cut it down where you can.
Yeah, it's all about improving the structure and the soil health, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Debbie, what are your hopes for the future of gardens in urban environments? And how do you think that individuals can contribute to actually making that a reality?
Well, I think everyone can make a difference. I think it's important to not feel overwhelmed with all these developments, because we can often feel as individuals that we are just a tiny, tiny piece and that whatever we do is not going to make a big difference to the overall picture. But there's been some interesting reports out. The RHS did a very good report. It was actually called, I sort of can have it for the notes, Garden Matters, Urban Gardens. Nice. And the sort of facts that they popped up in there was that 25% of land in cities is actually gardens. And when you sort of think about that, that's absolutely massive. Yeah. And also that the overall UK garden space, if you chomped them all together, actually added up to 500,000 hectares, which apparently is the size of Norfolk. You know, I don't know if that's about, but that is what they apparently equates to. So when you sort of think, if every single person, or even a fraction of those people, actually decided to garden with wildlife in mind and make some changes, you know, don't use pesticides, you know, introduce perhaps saving water so that there's not so much drain on natural resources, you know, put a water butt on the side of your house or rain chains, containers, that sort of thing. That can also reduce flooding because there's not so much water coming down just onto driveways or concrete or roads and so forth. There's more places for them to soak away. So I sort of think that where you've got a housing estate, where I used to feel really like, oh my gosh, that's land taken away. If you've got 150 houses being built on a housing estate, now I think the way to think about it is a positive that is potentially 150 gardens. So that's 150 new habitats, new gardeners, where you know, people can do good things. It's really just about enjoying nature every day, transforming perhaps these fields. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'd love there to be wildflower meadows, but if they're not to be, then I think we have to try and make best of the situation which is happening now, because we do need affordable housing for people. So it's making positive change to actually make the buildings work for us in terms of having more green spaces and more gardens. So hopefully there's huge benefits to these new, you know, this new wave of having housing estates.
Oh, I think that's a great way of looking at it, to be honest.
Well, look, Debbie, thank you so much for talking to us. And let's just really, really hope that some developers out there are listening and will take some of this amazing advice on board. And I think you're right. We've all just got to maybe campaign a little bit, not against the housing developments, but again, about how we can help. I think that's so key. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Debbie.
Thank you. Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, could I ask a small favour? Please take the time to review the show and share us with your colleagues. It really does make a difference and will help others to find us too. To keep up to date with the latest happening from the Underground, or sign up to our email newsletter at theunderground.fm. I'm Kate Turner, the Gardener Guru. I'm a horticulturist, garden consultant, and presenter. To find out more, check out my website at gardenerguru.co.uk.
And I'm Phil Wright, the founding partner of Wright O'Barra, a creative marketing agency specialising in the home and garden sectors. And for anyone bringing a new product to market, we've created a handy 7-step guide to help take your product marketing from zero to hero. Find out more at wrightobarra.com.